From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Have you purchased a cemetery plot, or do you have other plans for when you go? On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the changing design of cemeteries and their changing place in our lives. Also, we meet Judy Garland's other daughter, Lorna Luft. She sings on a new recording of the Gershwins' Girl Crazy. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews director Peter Sellers' irreverent production of The Marriage of Figaro. It will be shown this week on public television. And Maureen Carrigan reviews Streetwise, about two inner-city neighborhoods in Philadelphia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Five American diplomats arrived in Frankfurt, Germany today after defying Iraqi forces in Kuwait for more than 4 months. Ambassador Nathaniel Howell and four staff members were the last U.S. diplomats remaining in Kuwait. They kept the American embassy there open while assisting American citizens who were trapped by the Iraqi invasion. The British embassy is now the only foreign mission in Kuwait that's still staffed. Britain says its diplomats will stay until the weekend to make sure that there are no more British citizens who want to leave Kuwait. Baghdad and Washington, still not able to agree on a date for talks, have exchanged angry words. NPR's Jackie Lydon has more.
Neither side has said it will break off the intended talks, but each has accused the other of not taking them seriously. Baghdad says it wants Secretary of State James Baker to come to Iraq on January 12th, which Washington says is too close to the January 15th UN deadline for Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait. After a meeting with Israeli President Yitzhak Shamir, Secretary of State Baker said, "We've given them 15 separate dates between December 20th and January 3rd. They continue to insist on just this one day, so it doesn't look like they're particularly serious about getting this arranged." In Baghdad, a spokesman for the foreign ministry renounced Washington and said, "Iraq is the only party which defines the proper time for visiting its capital and meeting its president." Meanwhile, Baghdad announced today that it would begin civil defense and evacuation training for Baghdad on January the 15th. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
Blood bank officials in Washington, D.C. say the Pentagon has activated an emergency civilian blood collection program for the first time, apparently to prepare for fighting in the Persian Gulf. In Johannesburg today, thousands of supporters welcomed home ANC President Oliver Tambo after 30 years in exile. The ANC leader is still suffering the effects of a stroke, but as NPR's Renee Montaigne reports, Tambo managed to greet the cheering crowd.
When he stepped out onto the balcony of Johannesburg's airport, Oliver Tambo raised his arm in a power salute and smiled a broad smile. "We welcome you home," said his longtime friend Nelson Mandela, and indeed the crowd did, chanting and singing his name. The ailing Tambo did not speak to the crowd, but is due to address the opening session tomorrow of the ANC's historic conference, the first such gathering since the organization was banned 30 years ago. Tambo is expected to step down as president of the ANC soon, but many here say that despite his physical weakness, the highly respected leader will continue to help guide the organization, if only indirectly, as he did during his years in exile. In Johannesburg, I'm Renee Montaigne.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points today to close at 2,614.36. Advancing issues edged declines in active trading. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cemeteries offer what we like to describe as a final resting place. The new book, Silent Cities, shows what the cities of the dead have to tell us about the cities of the living. My guests are the co-authors. Kenneth Jackson is the author of a previous book about the suburbanization of America. He's a professor of history and urban planning at Columbia University. Camilo Jose Vergara is a photographer who spent the past decade documenting urban devastation in America's slums. Jackson told me what interested him about cemeteries.
Well, first of all, Terry, I would say that it's quite simply the world can be divided into two sorts of people, those who like cemeteries and who are fascinated by them and who like to walk around on them, and those people who are delighted if they never set foot in another one.
See, I thought you were going to say it was divided between the living and the dead.
That's another cut. But there really are quite a large number of people who find cemeteries to be fascinating. I think partly because They really force us to come to terms with our own mortality. When we're in a cemetery, it puts your mind on a different level. And the other thing is there's so much to learn and enjoy in cemeteries. They're places of beauty often. They're places where there are thousands of stories that you can sort of piece together as you look at the grave markers. It's a special kind of a place, and I think many people enjoy it.
Camilo, as a photographer, what did you want to do in documenting cemeteries, and why did you want to document them?
Well, that was a very interesting question to me, because I started from a very different point of view. That is, cemeteries were places where I had to go around. They were right in the middle of the old cities, and they were long blocks with just one entrance, and sometimes there was no way out. And I have done 12 years, maybe longer, of photographing of urban poverty. So I spend a lot of time in cities like Newark and Chicago and throughout the New York City area. And inevitably, as I was going around some of the poorest parts of those cities, I would find a very beautiful cemetery. And the contrast could not be stronger. And then, of course, that attracted my interest. First of all, was the tremendous contrast between the affluence of the dead and the poverty of the living, which is was so obvious.
Can you say that the first cemetery in the modern style in the United States is in New Haven? It was established in 1796, the Grove Street Cemetery. What makes this, in your mind, the first modern cemetery?
Well, because attitudes toward the deaths, at least the removal of the remains of the dead, have changed quite a bit over the centuries, both in this country and around the world. Before Grove Street was established in New Haven in the last part of the 18th century, the typical burial spot was outside a church. Now, the idea being that, you know, closer to the church you could be, the closer to heaven or closer to God. The problem was that over time, the churches were often located in the middle of the urban community, because that's where their parishioners were, and space became more crowded. What Grove Street represented, and Grove Street itself is not, you only see the beginnings of the new form of elite cemetery there. It was a little bit removed from the bustling city. It was more spacious. It won't seem spacious to the visitor today, but it was more spacious at the time. And it began to reorient thinking toward the cemetery as a place that might be beautiful. And these kinds of places were so successful and so beautiful that they really represent the first public recreational open park space really in this country.
What do you think it says about our beliefs about death that we've tried to create cemeteries that were beautiful with lots of trees and grass, not to mention monuments, open space?
Well, what it says is, and it was seen at the time as such, it was a sort of a negation of the finality of death. And it was the belief that through nature and through the nature coming alive with every season, with the flowers blooming and everything, that the bodies and the souls would be resurrected, and that the families would be reunited, so that the cemetery, with all the verdancy, was a reflection of a belief in immortality, that death was just sleep, that it wasn't going to be something that was going to last forever, and that most important, I think, that the family was going to be reunited. And that was a very important belief. And not just the family, but also the different groups. This happened later, you know, the engineers, the Salvation Army, the Nuns of the Sacred Heart, the firemen, and so on. So that that the end was not really an end.
One of the things you both wanted to do in your new book is to get a sense of what the differences have been in ethnic approaches to burial, the differences between Italians and Jews, between blacks and Hispanics. I'm curious, Camilo, in photographing headstones and tombstones, what are some of the striking differences you found between ethnic and racial groups in America?
Well, I found that the ethnic differences were very clear and very strong. so that you could, if you went to an Italian monument maker, or if you went to an Irish monument maker, or to an Irish section of a cemetery, you knew immediately because there were certain motifs that you would find over and over and over again. Same thing was true with German and Chinese and Japanese and so on. But I always had problems finding the difference between blacks and whites. I knew typically that if you went to a Newark cemetery and you look at people who had been buried there in the last 15 years, most likely those people would be black. Yet when I looked at their tombstones, I found that they were pretty much the same tombstones that whites of the same economic group would use.
You know, one of the things I wanted to pick up on, Terry, and just kind of make a very, very large point, is that it's my belief that if we all were to be destroyed by nerve gas next week, and so that the only thing that was remained of our civilization, or let's say, nuclear weapons, was our cemeteries, I think that a very careful scholar could piece together so many critical things about our civilization just from looking at the evidence of the cemetery. There you see, Terry, so many of the important things. First of all, we see the class nature of American society. There are clear and very profound and striking differences within cemeteries between the mausoleums of the very, very rich, let's say, and the very simple graves of the very, very poor. So you see this. You see, as Camilo has expressed with his photographs in the picture, the differences between the various ethnic groups. The Celtic crosses of the Irish look very different from the somber statues of the Germans, which look different from the uplifted figures of the Italian Americans. There are these differences that you can also see. The dissolution of the family in the last century, it's very common if you go to an older cemetery and let's say a grave marker, let's say in the early part of the 20th century, and you'll see one kind of tall shaft that'll have the family name on it. And then you'll see all scattered around of it, maybe a half a dozen, sometimes as many as 70 family members with little markers around, which is telling you something about the centrality of the family. Now, if you go to a cemetery, you'll most likely see a husband and a wife. Some cemeteries, in fact, won't even sell you more than two plots side by side. And now, with the rising divorce rate, we're not even going to see these kind of markers, forever together. So really, you're picking up so many aspects of American life just by looking at the cemetery within it. But to come back to this issue of racism or segregation, which I think we touched on, until very recently, especially in the South, but really throughout the country, blacks and whites spent no more time together in death than they did in life. In fact, there's a very famous marker in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, the grave marker of Thaddeus Stevens, who was a white congressman from Pennsylvania who was known for his leadership in radical Reconstruction after the Civil War. And he was buried in this old so-called Negro graveyard. And on Thaddeus Stevens' tomb, it says this, and he was white. It says, "I repose in this quiet and secluded spot, not from any natural preference for solitude, but finding other cemeteries limited as to race by charter rules. I have chosen that I might illustrate in my death the principles which I advocated through a long life, equality of man before his creator." But that was a very strong statement, just to be buried among black people, as if it made a huge difference. And I think that's part of this notion that we have, that the cemetery is such an accurate reflector of our society.
Well, while we're talking about how cemeteries reflect what happens in life in our society, I think it would be interesting to look at Potter's Field in New York, which is a burial ground for the poor and for the for unclaimed bodies. You both went there, right?
Yes.
And you need permission to go there. It's on a little island.
It was a very moving experience. It was early in the morning, and we waited in a sort of a shabby deck. We waited for the boat, but we didn't know that we were also waiting for the trucks that were going to bring the boxes, the pine boxes, where the bodies of grown-ups and children have been put, and sometimes limbs, the from a hospital or something. It just they are placed there and they are put in the big, big hole that has been dug at Potter's Field. So we took the boat, and that was almost a recreation of a sort of a mythical experience. You know, it was crossing expanse of water into the island of the dead. And you go to the island of the dead, and the island had been an old missile silo for the Nike missiles. And that's now abandoned. So there is this this missiles that could cause tremendous death and destruction were sharing the island with the poorest of all New Yorkers.
There's about 750,000 people buried in Potter's Field in New York.
It's one of the most densely settled cemeteries because the land is reused over and over. As Camilo said, they had this big hole, and they buried people in mass graves of 148 people to a particular grave, all unmarked. And therefore, it really does have power. Although I think in some ways the sorrow and the tragedy of Potter's Fields is less profound to us in 1990 than it would have been to our fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers generations ago.
Yeah, because they saved so hard to have a plot and a good cemetery that they could get their whole family
into. Well, to them, it was
into.
One of the worst things that you could imagine to be buried in a Potter's Field. Mm-hmm. That somehow they saved 10 cents a week, you know, immigrant in these immigrant communities or in these rural communities, so that when death came, that you could have a new dress and a nice coffin and be buried in a real grave and sort of go out in middle-class style at best. You know, now I think it's reflective of what we might call the death of the cemetery. I'm sure there are many people who wouldn't care whether they were buried in a Potter's Field or thrown out of an airplane or anything else. It seems it's somehow taken to be almost in irrelevance today, at least among many people, as to what happens to their bodies. And this kind of notion was almost inconceivable, I think, a century ago.
What are some of the other reasons you think that cemeteries are almost dying out themselves now?
Well, I think this is a real problem. It's hard to know all the reasons. I think just to draw the contrast, though, before we get into this discussion, I have a quotation from Judge Story in about 1831 when Mount Auburn Cemetery was dedicated. And his statement of what Mount Auburn was about then rings so strange in our own ears. Let me just read it to you. It says, "Dust as we are, the frail tenements which enclose our spirits but for a season are inexpressibly dear to us. We derive solace, nay pleasure, from the reflection that when the hour of separation comes, these earthly remains will still reclaim the tender regard of those whom we leave behind, that the spot where they shall lie will be remembered with a fond and soothing reverence, that our children will visit it in the midst of their sorrows, and our kindred in remote generations feel that a local inspiration hovers around it." They expected people to come visit their graves, and they thought that they would find inspiration there. We don't feel that very much anymore. We don't go to cemeteries. I gave a questionnaire out to class students of mine, both at UCLA and at Columbia University. And so many young people today have never even been to a cemetery, or maybe they've been once when their grandmother was buried. Very unlike the situation a generation or two or even 100 years ago, when visiting a cemetery was part of the ritual of growing up. You went to the cemetery on a regular basis, and that's where your parents took you. That was part of a weekend outing.
You know, I think part of the reason for this is that families have become so divided geographically that you'd have to fly often to visit the cemetery.
I take your point, and I agree with you, Terry, that we are somewhat more geographically dispersed, although I think social historians have, I think, demonstrated fairly convincingly that if anything, we move less today than we did 100 years ago, although we do move farther. But what I think is more striking is that even people who live within close proximity of a grave very, very seldom go there. In which, if you go to us, one of the reasons, in fact, ironically given for why people, especially women, don't go to cemeteries now is they're afraid. You're in a cemetery. You're often completely isolated. You could scream your head off, and there'd be no one there to hear you. And 100 years ago, especially on weekends, but really all the time, the cemetery was sort of full of people, almost like cemeteries are in Poland now, full of people. You go to a cemetery in Warsaw or somewhere like that, there are people all over the place, flowers, fresh flowers, even for people who've died a half a century ago. And that's the way American cemeteries were quite some time ago. They no longer are. We don't see them as central to a Pepsi generation. We now, unlike the Chinese, for example, we have reverence for youth, and we have surgery, and we go on diets. We do everything to mask the fact that we're older. And then when the time of death does come, no longer do we sort of die in a sort of grandeur in our house at a deathbed and calling in our friends and family members to sort of give a last word and maybe hear a last piece of wisdom from this person who's now experienced life. Now we're not dead until we go into a hospital and get plugged into 14 kinds of machines, and it's done where no one can see it, and then someone just says that, well, they're gone now. So the experience of death has been removed from it. It's almost like this is too disgusting to talk about.
My guests are the co-authors of the new book, Silent Cities, The Evolution of the American Cemetery. Kenneth Jackson wrote the text. He's the author of a previous book on the suburbanization of America. Camilo Jose Vergara took the photos. He spent the past decade documenting American slums. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Kenneth Jackson and Camilo Vergara, co-authors of Silent Cities, The Evolution of the American Cemetery.
Camilo, earlier in our conversation, you were talking about how you had documented decaying urban areas, and you'd have to often walk around these really beautiful, wealthy cemeteries.
That's right.
Have you also documented decaying cemeteries that have been abandoned or have been allowed to go to seed?
Well, first of all, that's something that is much more common in England than it is in the United States. In the United States, there's still interest, and the cemeteries, and by and large, still well cared, so that exceptionally you do see a cemetery, and that it's having problems. But oftentimes, that has to do with this, with the place, the placement of a cemetery. For instance, it's deadly to have a cemetery next to a high school because that means that the high school students are going to be crossing through it or passing through it, and it's going to be incorporated into any prank or any free time that they have. I remember a cemetery in Queens where one typical thing that students would do would be to topple angels. They would actually throw a rope over an angel and then pull it, and the angel would come crashing down. And then there were a number of monuments that all the cemetery could do, because it didn't have the funds to fix them, was to pile them up. And as you look around, you saw these hills full of cemeteries with thousands of names, full of tombstones, I'm sorry. And those were quite striking. Now, cemeteries have ended in some other ways. You know, some of them have been on the paths of expressways. Some of them have been in place of facilities that have been built, so that, and some of them have been in place of urban development, so that they have been moved elsewhere. And those cemeteries are lost because all you can see there is what has been put there new.
Do you each own plots in cemeteries for your future?
No, I don't.
I do, but that's a fairly unusual circumstance. I think I'm one of the few people who does own a plot.
Kenneth, I'm wondering if you ever visit the graves of relatives.
Well, I do, Terry. It's because I had a 16-year-old son who was killed in an automobile crash 6 years ago, and that, of course, has changed my circumstance. Incidentally, I was already working on the cemetery project before my son's death.
Right.
But that does take me back to the cemetery. I do return to it, not with great frequency, but certainly at least every month or so. And I do find that when I go there, sometimes I do not want to go there because to go there is to know that you're going to become sad. I do think that that's one of the reasons we don't like to go to cemeteries, is because it really does make us come to grips with something that's very painful to us. And that's why I realize that sometimes when I'm driving and when I drive into the cemetery, I turn off the radio, because somehow it seems that it's not right to be concerned with the latest news or the latest ball scores or something else if you're even approaching the grave of someone you love, which, by the way, is why I bought the plot, is when a tragedy like that happens, they'll only sell two at a time. So if you lose a child, you want very much to be buried beside that child. And otherwise, I'm sure I would not have prepared for that either. So that's why I'm a serious cemetery grave lot owner.
You could tell me if this is too personal, but when you visit your son's grave, do you feel like it's something you're doing more for you or more for him?
That's a tough one. I suppose maybe if I were to be honest with myself, it's more for him. I sort of feel like it's a way of telling him he's not forgotten. And the parent, I think, naturally feels, you know, you feel guilty if you survive your children. And that the very fact of survival, it's almost like being a Holocaust survivor. You know, it shouldn't have happened to you somehow. And you sort of want to go back, I guess for both of you. I don't know that I could separate those two out. But you sort of do feel, at least I feel, that I have to go back once in a while, even though every time I go, it hurts me.
Yeah. Well, let me say, I'm sorry to hear about your son.
Yeah. If I could add something to that.
Yeah.
It just sounded very... it seemed to me that in the cemetery, in the first period, and I mean, let's say if 1940 or 1950 was a big watershed when attitudes changed, before that period, the that kind of separation and the question that you just asked, Ken, it seemed to me would have been less on our minds than today. That was the great strength of the cemetery, was the fact that you could merge, is that your son was part of you. So you were your son and your son was you. So were your parents. And that the cemetery and to be with them, with all your ancestors in one place, or even within one cemetery, within different plots, offer you a possibility to place yourself in the past and to place yourself in the future. It offered you, it sounds like an amazing thing, but it did give you broad horizons.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very
much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure, Terry.
My guests have been Kenneth Jackson and Camilo Jose Vergara. Their book about American cemeteries is called Silent Cities. Next time, journalist Lawrence Weschler on Poland's difficult transition from communism to democracy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Lorna Luft on singing the part Ethel Merman created in the original 1930 production of the Gershwins' Girl Crazy. Luft's mother, Judy Garland, starred in the movie version. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Peter Sellers' contemporary updating of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. It will be shown this week on public television. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Streetwise, a study of two inner-city neighborhoods. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A plane arrived in Germany today carrying former hostages in Iraq and Kuwait, and also the last remaining diplomats from the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The U.S. vacated its embassy in Kuwait City today. Returning Ambassador Nathaniel Howell said the staff had been living without electricity and hot water for more than 100 days. The five remaining diplomats in the embassy left Baghdad on the last U.S. chartered flight to carry hostages out of Iraq and Kuwait. There were 94 passengers on the plane to Frankfurt, including 25 American hostages, many of whom were in hiding the past 4 months in Kuwait. State Department officials estimate about 500 U.S. citizens have voluntarily stayed in the region and say they must depart on commercial Iraqi flights should they decide to leave at a later date. More than 1,800 foreign hostages were evacuated this week after Saddam Hussein promised on December 6th the release of all foreigners. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein says that his country wants peace but will gladly go to war rather than allow foreign domination of Arab oil or land. According to the official Iraqi news agency, the Iraqi president told his cabinet that Iraq's enemies do not want it to stay an economic, military, or political power because they believe it is a danger that should not allow in the region. In Washington, a federal court judge turned down an appeal today from Democratic members of Congress who had asked that President Bush be barred from declaring war without consent of Congress. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Judge Harold Green ruled that it would be premature for the courts to intervene in a dispute between Congress and the White House over the Gulf situation. He said there might be an occasion when a majority of lawmakers would come to the court to prevent a president from going to war without consulting Congress. But, said Green, this is not such a situation. First of all, he said, only 10% of the Congress asked for court intervention, not a majority. And secondly, said Judge Green, an attack of Iraq is not yet a certainty. The president has ongoing diplomatic initiatives and must, under the Constitution, be given all the leeway he needs in that regard. In another case related to the Gulf situation, a second judge ruled today in favor of the administration. Judge Royce Lamberth threw out a court suit brought by an Army National Guard reservist who claimed he could not be sent to the Gulf without a congressional declaration of war. Judge Lamberth ruled that the courts could not intervene. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
And in New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 8 points to close at 2,614.36. On volume of some 162 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by only a slight margin in very active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Controversial productions of Mozart's operas The Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, and Così fan tutte were directed by Peter Sellers and conducted by Craig Smith last year. The productions were taped in Europe and will be shown on the Great Performances series on PBS. The Marriage of Figaro begins the cycle, and many stations are airing it this Friday. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz loved the original production and has a preview of the telecast.
The Marriage of Figaro is the most warmly human of Mozart's three great operas with librettos by Lorenzo da Ponte. Although the music plumbs depths of cynicism and despair, it also conveys an essential belief in the human heart. By the end, Figaro, the former barber of Seville, has a new bride, He's helped smooth the rocky relationship of his wife-beating, sex-addict master, the Count Almaviva, and the Count's desperate young wife, Rosina. He's even discovered who his true parents are. At Figaro's wedding, his parents also get married. Most productions of Figaro emphasize farce, the tricks, disguises, and surprises in the closet or under the bedspread. But director Peter Sellers is out for bigger game. His updated production takes place at Christmas in New York, high above the city in a lavish penthouse in the Trump Tower. The inhabitants can look out at the magnificent skyline, a gorgeous sunset, or the city lights glittering below. But as Cole Porter put it, they're down in the depths on the 90th floor and up to their ears in loneliness, frustration, and jealousy. The brilliant Sellers production, conducted with such uncanny sympathy by Craig Smith, has been faithfully taped for television at a studio in Vienna with its original cast, scenery, and costumes intact. Of course, some things are different. There are close-ups. There are subtitles in witty contemporary English. Figaro's famous Act I aria, Se vuol ballare, for example, emerges quite accurately as, "If you want to dance, Count Baby, I'll play backup guitar." And unlike most static opera for television productions, the camera never stops moving. Sellers apparently had in mind more the intimacy of TV soap opera than grand opera from the stage of the Met, and it works wonderfully. If the elegant symmetries of the stage production are lost, something important is also gained. We get very close to these all-too-human characters and find them uncomfortably like ourselves. Yet at the end, when the Countess catches her wayward husband in his most blatant infidelity, we can see close up the genuineness of his plea for pardon and the miracle of the Countess's loving forgiveness that seems to bless everyone in earshot. It's one of the most moving, ecstatic moments I've ever seen or heard on television. Sellers and Smith couldn't have pulled this off without a uniformly superlative cast. Great ensemble performances often mean the extraordinary individuals get short shrift, but I want to list them for you, starting with the amazing Jean Omerle and Sanford Sylvan, so loving and volatile as Susanna and Figaro. there's James Maddalena's menacing yet understandable count, Jane West's fragile yet elegant countess, and Susan Larson's Carabino, the horny adolescent who uncovers the mystery of the erotic life. David Evitz and Sue Ellen Kuzma as Figaro's parents, and Frank Kelly as a self-loathing go-between, all find the underlying humanity of their comic roles. These mercurial, probing, and superbly sung performances put almost any other opera you've seen on television, or anywhere, to shame. Bravo, PBS. Bravo, everyone.
And bravo, Lloyd Schwartz. He just won his third Deems Taylor Award for music criticism. This is Fresh Air. The 1930 musical Girl Crazy by George and Ira Gershwin launched the career of Ethel Merman. When she sang I Got Rhythm, she held a C note for 16 bars and the audience went wild. Other songs from the musical that have since become standards include Embraceable You and But Not For Me. Now Girl Crazy's original score and original orchestrations have been restored in a new recording just released by Elektra Nonesuch. Lorna Luft sings Merman's part. Luft's mother, Judy Garland, starred in the 1943 movie version. Here's Lorna Luft singing I Got Rhythm.
Days can be sunny with never a sigh. Don't need what money can buy. Birds in the tree sing their day full of song. Why shouldn't we sing along? I'm chipper all the day, happy with my lot. How do I get that way? Look at what I've got. I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man who asks for anything more. I got daisies in green pastures, I got my man who could ask for anything more. Old man Trouble, I don't mind him, you won't find him round my door. I got starlight, I got sweet dreams, I got my man who could ask for anything more. Who could ask for anything more?
I think that you sing differently on Girl Crazy than you would if you were singing the same songs in a club.
Oh, sure. We were held very, very true to the material on Girl Crazy. It was quite difficult because you have much more freedom when you are doing a show, per se, on the stage or in a nightclub or whatever. But when you're going to do a recording, and especially a recording that is going to put back together all of the original arrangements and reproduce practically everything that happened in 1930, you have to learn how they sung in those days, so you can't really interpolate at all.
So let's look at a song like I Got Rhythm, for instance. That's the song you've probably sung in concert.
Mm-hmm.
Describe how that compares with how you're doing it on Girl Crazy.
Well, on Girl Crazy, first of all, the tempo was so much faster than I had been singing it. And plus, it was completely done exactly on rhythm.
On the beat.
On the beat. And that was interesting because most people who sing the song, they never sing it that way. They either stretch out the word I or they stretch out the word got, or they drop a beat before they say the word rhythm. And then those famous ahs that Miss Merman did on the stage, I don't exactly know how they came about, if they were taught to her by George Gershwin or by Roger Edens, who was the original pianist on the show. But whoever taught them to her sure laid down history, and we had to repeat it.
Let's compare I Got Rhythm to a more subdued song that you sing on Girl Crazy, Boy, What Love Has Done to Me. And this is more of a ballad. It's do you feel more comfortable belting or being more restrained in your singing?
I feel comfortable singing, period.
Mm-hmm.
I like doing both. Obviously, on a ballad, it's harder to sing a ballad because you have to have more control. That's actually a lot more fun for me because it's more of a challenge. The hardest thing to do is to sing quietly. Anybody can get out there and, you know, rah, and belt and, you know, do all of that. And people think, I've seen this with young singers, that the louder you are, the better you are. And it's really not true. It's the quieter you are is the more interesting, because then the audience has to lean forward a little bit more and they have to listen. They truly have to listen to you.
I fetch his slippers, fill up the pipe he smokes. I cook the kippers, laugh at his oldest jokes. Yet here I anchor, I might have had a banker. Boy, what love has done to me.
You started to sing in clubs when you were still a teenager, I think, right?
I was about 18, 19.
Were you expected to have all the fixings, the evening gowns, a chorus of young men?
Everything.
Uh-huh. Did you want all that? I mean, I'm not exactly sure of your age, but I figure you probably grew up with rock and roll as well as with with standards and show tunes and stuff. And I was wondering if you felt a part of that sensibility, if that's totally what you wanted to be on stage.
I'll tell you something. I was so young, and I had just come off doing my first Broadway show, which was Promises, Promises. And I was so young and naive, and I listened to all these people that had major offices with views, lots of windows. And I figure if you have an office with a view, you're a big shot. And I guessed that I listened to all of these people because I thought they knew what they were doing. And to say that I didn't listen to myself would not be right, because I really didn't know what I wanted at that point. They put me into gowns and orchestrations, and I spent a fortune with all of that. And I thought that they knew what they were doing, and I thought that this was the right thing for me to do. I thought that that's immediately what you did. You came off the Broadway stage, and then you put a nightclub act together, and that's what you did. And basically, that's what a lot of people have done and are still doing. My problem was that I was so young that I didn't realize that I was being exploited. And that,
exploited how?
Oh, because, I mean, there were giant billboards on my way down to Atlantic City for the first time when we premiered the club act that, you know, had huge letters of Judy Garland's daughter and Liza Minnelli's sister, and then you had to take a magnifying glass to my name. It was a nightmare. And, you know, I was 18 years old, and I thought, well, I guess they know what they're doing.
What's the difference between the way you perform now in concert and the way you were performing when you were still a teenager and being pushed as Judy Garland's daughter or Liza Minnelli's sister?
Well, I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
So like, what's the difference in your repertoire or in, the stage act itself?
What's different is every single thing in my shows now I have put together. I have done. No one has said, you must sing this because it's on the radio, or because it's popular, and because everyone likes it. And you see, when I was 18 years old, I was singing songs that I was told that I should be singing.
When you were growing up, how old were you when you became aware of the problems your mother was having with drugs and alcohol? And I wonder if that created a lot of hardship for you.
Well, I think that I think that right now we are in a society that has accepted people with their problems, and I think due to people who are courageous as Betty Ford and as courageous as Elizabeth Taylor, I think it's made it more acceptable in the fact that people don't look at you like you're a leper or don't feel. They now say to you, gee, I think you're very courageous. I watched Kitty Dukakis do her entire book tour. My heart just, you know, broke for her having to sit in that chair and having people ask her those questions.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it's come to. Unfortunately, when my mother was having her problems, she couldn't do that because it was pushed into closets and shut up in, you know, behind doors and all of that. And so, in a way, I guess the one thing I wanted to say is I wish the clock had rolled back, that there was a Betty Ford in my mom's time, and maybe, you know, it could have saved her and all of that. But, you know, you can't really keep thinking like that. But I admire the people who have done it today because, you know, it's an incredibly difficult childhood to live through. And but it's not only myself. I haven't lived through anything else that someone in Ohio or Nebraska or whatever hasn't lived through either.
There's only one more thing I have time to ask you, and that is, remember, we're talking about the songs that you do now and your performances mm-hmm. that you really like a lot. What songs are they? The ones that you include in your performances that you really like. What kind of songs?
Oh, gosh. In this new show, I put in a whole 15-minute piece of Girl Crazy, which is really terrific. I've put in His Is the Only Music That Makes Me Dance, which was a brilliant song that Julie Stein wrote for the play of Funny Girl. It was taken out of the movie. Those are the kinds of things that I like to find. Songs that you remember that they touched you when you first heard them, and maybe people haven't heard them for quite a long time. Not the popular songs that are really on the radio today, because I don't know why I wouldn't be singing an MC Hammer song up at Rainbow and Stars. Call me wacky, but, you know, I don't know, you know. Gershwin, MC Hammer, I just don't see it together.
Lorna Luft, thank you very much for talking with
us. Okay, thank you.
Lorna Luft sings on the new recording of Girl Crazy. She's performing at Rainbow and Stars in Manhattan through December 29th and returns New Year's Eve. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. You remember the story of the doctor who invented a machine which assisted very ill people in committing suicide? He was charged with murder. Today, that charge was thrown out of court, and we'll have a story on that. Also, another court decision regarding the relative rights of the Congress and the President to conduct a war. We'll also be taking another look, as we have been doing all week, at groups of people and what they think really is worth dying for, this time members of Congress who might have to vote for war, and the Secretary of Education who's quit. We ask why.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When sociologist Elijah Anderson moved into his West Philadelphia neighborhood in 1975, he found an idea for a book literally at his own doorstep. Streetwise is a study of two urban neighborhoods, the integrated one Anderson lives in, which he calls The Village, and the nearby ghetto neighborhood, which he calls Northton. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
For 14 years, Elijah Anderson did field work in The Village and Northton communities. Both poor and wealthy people live there. So do WASPs, Jews, Irish and Italian Americans, gays, aging hippies, newly arrived Southeast Asians, Pakistanis, and middle-class blacks like Anderson himself. He spent hours on the streets talking to people. He hung out at bars, laundromats, and school board meetings and got to know everybody, from small-time drug dealers to community activists. Anderson wanted to see if all these people could relate to each other as individuals, apart from their groups. And what he found out is they usually can't. But fortunately, this non-revelation about the alienation of city life isn't the only enlightenment that Streetwise offers. Anderson dissects everyday urban rituals, like walking the dog or navigating our way down the street, to show how racial and class prejudice affect our behavior. He videotapes street corner scenes and interviews pedestrians and demonstrates that everybody, whatever their skin color, becomes more alert when a young black man walks toward them. These street situations are the same in all cities, but Anderson's observations about white racism in the village are especially poignant because that neighborhood is supposed to be more tolerant than other places. In the 1950s, Quakers established integrated housing there. Later, 60s counterculture and university types moved in. But Anderson says that over the past two decades, the people in the village have distanced themselves from one another. They've come to value personal protection more than they do diversity. This change in the village has been fueled by even more drastic changes in nearby Northton. Once a black working-class community, Northton has been leveled by drugs and unemployment. Anderson speaks with a lot of Northton residents, and although sociology books like Streetwise don't usually make for spellbinding reading, these interviews are chilling. Anderson tells of one elderly woman who protects herself from local gang members by baking them birthday cakes and giving them cough drops for their cocaine-induced coughs and sniffles. He also interviews a white cop in Northton who tells him that, within a mile of this police station, there are thousands of abused children. The future is a tornado waiting to happen, and it's going to tear us apart. Anderson's book is targeted to city dwellers who haven't chosen to run away to the suburbs yet. But he doesn't have many fresh solutions to offer. More jobs, better schools, decent housing. Given the devastation Anderson finds in Northton, you've got to wonder what solutions can save our cities. Because if a book like Streetwise can be said to have a moral, it's that the destinies of gentrified and ghetto neighborhoods are as concretely linked as the streets that connect them.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Streetwise by Elijah Anderson. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Bob Alls. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Lawrence Weschler of The New Yorker looks at Poland today and its difficult transition from communism to democracy. Infighting has replaced the spirit of solidarity. And just in time for the holidays, we talk champagne with the co-editors of The Wine and Food Companion. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.